Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode, Consumerism as an Ethos. Why can't money buy happiness? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce.
And I'm River. And what do you mean, money can't buy us happiness?
Don't listen to them. They told us the same thing about love.
Aha! Shut up and take my money!
So, when we say consumerism as an ethos, a system of ethics, what do we mean by that?
Is consumerism an ethos?
Well, I feel like, at the very least, that in the modern American landscape, our participation in the economic system around us has gone from being just a positive, just something that is looked favorably upon, to being an actual duty. We see this regularly in our culture, needing the economic engine of constantly buying new products. We see a lot of disposable products, a lot of things that have planned obsolescence. Ideas like this are built into the way we create things so that people will buy more of them, because without continual growth, without continually buying more and more stuff, we start to falter.
That's fair. I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of that sort of going around, especially during holiday seasons, Christmas time and the like. You see a lot of the, you know, come out early for Black Friday and buy stuff from us. And this sort of weird myth that comes about that turns out to be not actually true, but the whole, like, this is how companies are actually staying afloat is doing what in the industry is known as loss leader selling, where they're not actually getting money from it. They're losing money on selling these big items during, like, Black Friday and the run-up to the holiday season, and that it's almost part of our duty as good Americans to forego family gatherings and stuff like that to try and get the best deal and make sure you have fancy presents for everyone you know. And that a little bit, if you're not spending money on people for gifts, you're a bad person. You're not doing your job, as it were.
Well, we see an example of that in the way that Black Friday promotions are pushed back more and more each year, till now they're starting on Thanksgiving directly. We're being asked, in some sense, to give up an actual holiday, an actual family gathering point, to go participate in the consumerism, because that somehow is an equivalently good action to developing family connections in that way. If nothing else, it's a very strong case for replacement of certain kinds of values with consumerist values.
Every time there's a small holiday, even President's Day or Labor Day, Memorial Day, which are medium-sized bank holidays, you see all these deals coming up for furniture and electronics and this, that, and the other thing, and you almost feel like at some point, when are we going to start seeing, like, Arbor Day sales and stuff like that? The sort of reinforcement of, we have the day off, or we potentially have the day off because of a national holiday. We should spend it doing what these companies are trying to say is the national pastime, which is spend the money we would be making otherwise.
You mean you don't go to Arbor Day sales?
Not generally.
What would one sell on Arbor Day?
Trees.
I can see your point, especially Labor Day sales in particular, kind of interesting in that way, in that the labor movement is about the workers who are bringing in the pay at the bottom of that grade, and yet the people who benefit from Labor Day sales are the people at the top of the capital chain.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that and the fact that you're having people work often extended hours on Labor Day, which seems almost counterintuitive to what the labor movement was trying to accomplish and still trying to accomplish in many ways, is better, more consistent and less stressful work hours and working conditions. And suddenly you're throwing people who are probably not unionized. Let's be fair. There's unfortunately not a lot of or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, a lot of unionization of low-level, quote-unquote, entry-level work positions in this country.
Statistically, Americans work harder and for longer hours than just about every other country. So it might make sense that the only chances that we have to spend the money we're making by doing so much working, we're, you know, exhorted to do so at every opportunity we can. But it's unsurprising that the retail advertisers would tell us that consumerism is a positive ethos at all. I mean, they have every interest in doing so. The question, I suppose, is how seriously should we take that?
I think that's exactly the meat of the question we want to get to. Should we see consumerism as an ethos, as a good force or a negative force in our lives? In general, I'm going to come down on the negative force side of this question. I think that, especially when we start replacing things like value in intangible things, value in culture, value in music, value in social justice, value in all of these other elements that are not directly applicable to the consumerist model, with those that are directly applicable, having a nicer SUV to drive around in, more bling to wear, whatever else, those things being replaced are of a higher value. If they're not more important to an individual, they're more important to all of us as a collective. And so I would tend to see the move towards consumerist ethics as being a negative impact in general.
You know, Sean, you raise a particularly valid point. I think maybe I should start paying all of my employees in intangible things.
Wait, we were getting paid in tangible things?
I fed you, didn't I?
I like eating.
Food is good.
If there were to be a positive impact, what would we need to establish? What would be required? And that way we can flesh it out a little bit more to see exactly what we're going for here and maybe understand the underpinnings of the question a little bit better.
Well, I think that's a valid point, actually, on some level, right? You do need a certain level of tangible stuff. There's a certain need for food and other basic necessities, and then we can assume that beyond that we'd all like to have at least a little bit of comfort items, right? We'd like to have a little bit better food than what is absolutely required for sustaining life. So maybe there is a reasonable level, a reasonable lifestyle that is at a particular point in that. But at the point that the only joy that we get out of the world is having more or better stuff, aren't we eroding the other things that could be giving us joy?
In determining, trying to separate that sort of tangible versus intangible value, it seems to me there are a number of stages. There are some very obvious things which clearly have, objectively have tangible value. Food, shelter, clothing, and so forth. As you move further towards, you know, to how nice of a bed do you need? Do you really need a bed? Questions like that. But then you can move any further. Like, do you need the hot new iPhone? I'd say that's clearly intangible. However, some of the functions of, or do you need cell phone service? But some of the functions of cell phone service, the ability to get information and to communicate wherever you might be, these are objectively better than not having them. You could call that tangible, although less so than some other things. It's almost like a hierarchy of needs.
I was just thinking about Maslow and the hierarchy of needs. I definitely think there are certain things, the sort of base requirements for living or for living with any sort of comfort, a place to live, running water, food, electricity in many ways, especially in this culture, things like that. And then you have items that are a little nicer, but also fulfill some of the lower level of the hierarchy of needs, the ability to communicate via cell phone and stuff like that. And then you have things that don't really fulfill the hierarchy of needs other than as forms of self-actualization or forms of identity, these sort of prestige items that they may have some utilitarian function, but mostly what they're for is status symbol, as it were. A nice car as opposed to one that simply works and works well, or a fancy watch, a fancy cell phone that would cost more. Maybe it does a little more, but maybe not more than the prestige value you'd be getting out of it. And a big part of the consumer culture is the want of these prestige items, the respect or the intangible value you get out of owning them or seeing someone who owns them, as opposed to their actual just utilitarian benefit.
I think we've got a useful start here in aligning economic value of goods with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I would add the observation that as you go further up that hierarchy, more and more arbitrary the goods are which can produce it. If you're looking for something that fulfills inner desires of satisfaction, it really could be just about anything, depending on what your culture is telling you is a prestige item, or what everybody's into, the cool new thing, or whatever. It could be anything.
Well, I think that actually gets really close to something that I was concerned about in this, and that's that while Maslow's hierarchy of needs is interesting, it's really about basic human biological functioning at some point, right? The base needs are not the base needs of living in a society, they're the base needs of human beings not dying, right? And then Maslow goes immediately into these more psychological needs. But as a culture, we've recognized that there are certain, maybe not needs per se, but very important status items like phone service. We don't need phone service to be able to survive, but we've decided as a culture that it should be available to everyone because it's an important part of participating in the way our culture, our society is structured. Now the debate is starting to turn towards the internet. Is internet access a similarly necessary element of living in the society? So to some degree, we are at a point of having to ask, do I just need the things that allow me to survive, or do I also need the things that allow me to participate in the place I live?
Well, I definitely think the latter would be more true, especially because, at least in America, we have this idea of the American dream and building yourself up from maybe a low position to being successful in a capitalistic sense and having value, equity, things like that. And more these days, you have to have access to things like phone service and the internet and the ability to communicate with people more openly to try and achieve these things.
I guess I'm a little bit stuck on the things being higher up being more arbitrary. I'll put it this way. The things that we just need to survive, their value lies entirely in utility. The cell phone still has utility because communication and gathering of information are concretely goods. I don't think we could argue that those are just completely flighty and could be anything. But a lot of stuff, you know, what app games do people enjoy or are into, tend to sort of go with the culture. It could be one thing or another. So I guess the question is, how much of the value of a thing, it comes from its utility, the remainder being arbitrary?
Well, I think there's a point to be had there, but at the same time, communication is not hampered necessarily by my not having a cell phone, right? I can still communicate, I can still write letters, I can still talk to people, I can still communicate in other ways. However, it is definitely harder for me to do it. And it certainly puts up barriers to my participation in the society the way it's been constructed here in America, if nothing else. So to what extent something is arbitrary has to do, it seems to me anyway, with how much participation in certain kinds of cultural groupings one intends to do. If you live out in the woods and you live in your cabin that you built yourself and you go out and fell trees for firewood and you trap your own animals and you have enough property to be able to do that and live completely off the grid, how much intrinsic value lies in having a cell phone, right? How much value would that actually have if there's no one you want to call?
I wouldn't necessarily want to agree with the notion that we are no better off here in the 21st century than in the early 20th century when most places lived on subsistence farming. And there are some approaches that people take that try to go back to that simpler time, that don't think it's worth it, all of the complexity in society that we've created and all of the tools and toys that we've had. I do think we are better off than we were then in some tangible way, but there is a lot of complexity involved, so it's very difficult to tease out exactly what that is.
Well, I think the only place that I'm trying to go with is the notion that on some level, what I choose to participate in dictates what needs I have. Right, if I want to be someone who goes out and hang glides, I have to have a hang glider. That becomes a need of a sort for me, based on a self-actualizing cycle of some sort. But at some level, I don't needed, in big air quotes, to survive. So is survival the standard by which we judge our needs, or should there be another standard? If the standard is our societal good, then we have to ask the question, does our societal good include an ethic to participate in what makes our societal good work, like consumerism?
This is one thing that I've noted during economic crashes. Simple question I've asked. It's fairly difficult to answer on the face of it. Where'd all the money go? Because your basic Adam Smith economics, all wealth comes from the amount of work and knowledge and the amount of natural resources within a country. We have an economic crash. None of that went away. So why are we not just as wealthy as we were before when there's just as many people who are willing to work, they have all the skills they had, and we have all the same natural resources? And what we lose is the organization. So if we all are on the same page as to what we want to buy, what the hot new thing, what the fashion trend is, and stuff like that, it's sort of like aligning us as molecules to create magnetism, in some extent. If we're all on the same page, we're all working on the same thing, regardless of whether it has any objective value, we as a society become stronger because we're working in the same directions, even if that direction is sort of spinning its wheels.
I don't necessarily think that's true because, and you bring up the economic crash, that's a lot of what, without getting into too much detail, the last big financial crisis was about, is this sort of idea that we'll be better off than we were, this idea of the American dream. I'm hesitant to call it a lie, but this concept of the American dream where if we do what we're supposed to, we'll be better off. And that ended up falling through due to a lot of different and yet serious things that ended up just completely crashing the housing market and basically causing a breakdown of a certain part of our economy for a good chunk of time.
Well, and we see to a large extent the impact that this kind of structure within our economy can have by looking at what's gone on with China's economy recently. We see that there is a vast increase in the amount of production going on, but that the level of consumption hasn't caught back up to it. This is why there are entire complex city structures that have been built to develop real estate that don't have anyone living in them yet. It's in the hopes that in the future, consumption will catch back up and people will want to live in these luxury apartments. But for now, the Chinese consumer has gone from a state of being fairly lower-end, lower-class, living off of subsistence farming in a lot of cases, to being a manufacturing economy and suddenly having this middle-class income. And we see something very similar to what we saw after the Great Depression. People hoarding money. People who are not prepared to spend and consume in the way that is necessary for that economic engine to keep turning. So, in some sense, that's a good, right, for the whole of the economy, for the whole of the country that functions on that economy. For people to do that is a good for them. The question is, and I actually kind of like your magnets metaphor, Bruce, if we're all lined up for something like this that attracts some other element in the system, right? We're all lined up on the iPhone train and we all want to attract more technological advancement by supporting it through this process. That's great as long as there's no cost to it. But there is a cost to it, and that's where we come into a problem, in my opinion, anyway. The cost is what we give up to value the iPhone in that way. What we have to give up both monetarily, in the opportunity cost of the things we could have done had we not bought a very new fancy $600 cell phone, and in terms of what values we give up by putting our attention on something like the newest, fanciest technology or the status symbol.
There's also a risk. Speaking of economic downturns, remember those house flipping shows? Everybody was like, yeah, we gotta get rental properties, we gotta turn houses around. The one before that, it was savings and loan crisis. There was between those, there was the internet bubble. Every single time that that one particular industry gets so much attention put onto it, it creates a bubble. That interest inflates it, and the tangible value of it doesn't change, but the perceived value of it becomes so much greater that there becomes a huge margin between what the actual cost of these companies that you have them all together is and what they're valued at currently on the stock market, and then it bursts, and then everybody's broke. And, you know, it could be pogs, it could be tulips. this thing happens again and again. What's when if everybody gets too much on the same page, it creates an inflated value on the thing we're onto, and then it bursts and everyone's left hanging. Probably because they were going into that thing instead of what they could have been going into that actually had real utility.
But not all bubbles are bad, right? I mean, sometimes the bubble's actually good for us. When we look at the tech bubble of the 1990s, we had the development of a lot of very innovative companies that were formed in that era who, yes, the bubble burst in a larger sense, but they came out of it very strong. Amazon's the key example of that.
Google.
Amazon, yeah, Google, a lot of these companies were fueled by the bubble because there was so much investment, because there was so much attention on it, they were able to get the growth capital that they needed to expand in really big ways. Now, admittedly, the losers in that system, every website that ever tried to sell dog food for a living and the like, is basically going to be a much larger total percentage, right? Because the system of bubbles creates a few winners and a lot of losers. But it's not bad for everybody, and it's not always bad for us culturally.
That's fair, but I mean, I think the most recent bubble definitely left people a bit in the cold, both figuratively and literally, in that the winners from the people that actually came out ahead from the last bubble burst was the bankers, the heads of these giant corporate banks that just walked away with billions of dollars.
Yeah, the ratio of winners to losers of that was insane. And any event like that, I would rather have steady, sustained growth than a bubble, cyclical bubble situation.
Well, and I will admit that the cyclical bubble, or the boom and bust cycle, is really not very good for us overall. But I think that in some cases, anyway, it can be incredibly advantageous. You mentioned Google. Google's a great example. How would our world be different if it weren't for Google having come along and revolutionized just the search game, right? Ignore all the investments Google's made and all the other things they've reached out into. Just the internet search industry, right, was so deeply changed by it, and in a way that was actually greatly to the advantage of consumers, right? That had a very deep impact on the way our world could develop going forward. It's not that every time it's going to be useful. Sometimes it's going to be completely trash, and there's going to be no upside from it. When we talk about the housing bubble, though, I actually think there's a really interesting answer to what's going on there. I don't think we've seen all the winners yet. I think we're just starting to see some of the winners. The immediate winners were the big banks that got bailed out and didn't have to basically pay for the things that they had screwed up. But there's another set of winners that came along later, and those are people who wanted to buy property, but weren't able to before because of the inflated prices. But after the bubble, we're able to come in and snap that up for single-family dwellings and the like, the things that our property market should have been doing in the first place.
Yeah, I think if we hadn't milled out the banks, the properties could have gone a lot lower.
But should they have?
Yeah, there's a give and take there, because when you're talking about like property and equity and things like that, sometimes, you know, it isn't a company or a big bank, but an individual seller, and if... I'm not talking about necessarily, like, they're trying to make a bunch of money off of this, but maybe they're trying to get a return on the investment, and that's kind of part of what drives a capitalistic society, is you're supposed to invest and then get money from that investment and then go back and put that money into investing in more things. That's how it's supposed to drive forward. Doesn't necessarily always work that way, but that's kind of how it's supposed to go. As far as, like, advancement in a capitalistic society, is if you have a good idea, people will invest in it. But if there's, you know, no money to invest in it, you're kind of boned.
I think that the very low availability of housing at this point tells us that the bubble burst left the property values about as low as they should have been. Possibly a little bit too low, even. If the property prices had dropped any lower, there would be zero availability of new property in the market. And that would have just caused the exact opposite reaction of a huge spike back up in prices. As soon as the supply dropped because people snapped up $10,000 houses, right, all of a sudden the people who were remaining after that would have held on to their property waiting for that to happen more and more until there was no availability for the next wave of buyers. The fact that we've ended up in a 3-5% availability situation means that things dropped about as much as the system could handle.
I'd like to actually try to bring him back to some interesting definitions we touched on earlier, which is the notion of how much value is tangible value or utility versus how much is perceived value. In a free market, we allow people to determine the value of something entirely for themselves, which is fair. But as we've discussed at length, some very often people overvalue some things, undervalue other things, in terms of the actual utility of the thing. And we touched on utility as relating to survival. I might also relate it as to, like, power. If I have a cell phone, I can communicate more often, easily, and quicker than if I do it through pen or paper or other means, so you could say I have more communication. Also comes into a deal with travel a lot. We've kept gas prices low for the last century in America so that we can drive all around and move goods all around, and we've got the interstate highway system, and that has given us a lot of economic ability to get goods where we need to go, to move or to travel or visit further. The distances that most Americans commute, people in Europe would think would just be, like, really high even just for a trip. We have power to do things in the world. And to that degree, I would say, is what the tangible value or the utility value of something is.
I think that the Europe and the USA example is a little bit skewed because the nature of the geography of the place impacts it. America is a very large, in a physical sense, place.
Third largest in the world.
That alone means that there's going to be some necessity. I don't know if everybody would agree that we've kept gas prices particularly low. When you look at Venezuela and Argentina, you see gas prices in the 35 cents kind of range, as opposed to the $5 a gallon for a while that we experienced. I'm not saying that we haven't subsidized them. We absolutely have, but not to the extent that some other places have. Now, admittedly, when you compare that with Germany at $8 for a liter, you're talking about a very different level of subsidization. But in terms of what power that gives us out in the world, if you don't have to travel as far to get to something, then you don't need gas to be cheaper. It doesn't offer you any more power to be able to travel 30 miles to a grocery store rather than 3 miles.
I'm thinking very, very tangible, almost engineering terms, because I'm trying to make this as concrete as possible. Traveling 300 miles is useful, more use of more power than traveling 30, even if your countries are closer together here than there.
Right.
The necessity might change, but the actual amount of will you have exerted on the tangible world is greater. And that's, I think, how we get the utility of value.
In terms of sailing ships, right? It's more costly to sail a ship all the way around the globe to get to a place that's 7 miles west of you than it is to ride a carriage 7 miles over. That doesn't mean it's a useful advantage. It just took more, right? Like, you didn't get more out of it because you sailed the entire circumference of the world. You just got the same amount you would have gotten for doing it the other way. So the opportunity cost is basically increased for no apparent reason.
Yeah, and this kind of points out the difficulty of figuring out what the real value of something is. Because sometimes, very often, I want something, my value for it, is as a tool to get the next thing that I want. Which might be as a tool to get the next thing they want. There might be a cycle of circles within circles, and that defines my lifestyle. Of, I have this, so I can have this, so I can have that, so I can have that, so I can have this. So, yes, while what I was trying to get at before, which is the measurable impact you can have on the world, there's a question of why would you want to have that impact on the world? Why are you choosing this to value instead of that? And while it's useful, it might get us towards actually trying to nail this down, that it is measurable, tangibly so, there are different ways to do it, and you're often chasing your own tail when you chain a bunch of needs to get other needs to get other needs. So I think this may be why we very often leave it to people to determine value for themselves, because the alternative would be to have some sort of centrally planned committee deciding what the value of things are. It gets into a who decides, if not catch as catch can.
That's fair, and in a free market with perfectly rational actors, the amount of supply versus the amount of demand would absolutely determine the median value of all things, but there are also things like status symbol involved and prestige and stuff like that, where things will get priced up because of the perceived status value of them and things like that. Jewelry, fancy watches, fancy cars, stuff like that, where it may cost slightly more to make them than their less prestigious cousins, but they will oftentimes cost much, much more.
Yeah, as complex as it is, there is the notion of a free market full of rational actors is as silly as asking who can jump the highest of all of the Martians. We don't care. That doesn't exist. It isn't here. So once we throw in the fact that we're a bunch of psychological nutcases on this planet...
Well, but I don't think that's even necessary. I mean, a bunch of rational actors can still make the worst decision possible. Traffic jams are the perfect example of this. Everyone makes the right rational decision to get on the road that goes the fastest back to the place that they want to go. And yet, by making what seems, from an individual's point of view, the most rational decision, we are still making the worst possible decision once you encounter other people. If everybody tries to use the same road because it's the fastest way back to their house, well, then everybody's going to be stuck in more traffic and they're going to actually end up with a slower trip home. More importantly, though, we also impact those decisions, right? We impact which kinds of value people take, not by some central committee that passes out which values to have and which not to, but by how we promote things within our culture. What we're talking about on some level is what's called badge value. Right? The value that something has in an entirely social way. So the fancy jewelry has value only in so much as someone else views my fancy jewelry and says, oh, how fancy is your jewelry? We can control badge value. As a matter of fact, we see a great example of that during World War I when the Hungarians were asked to give up their gold jewelry so as to support the war effort. And what they got back in return were iron casts of the same jewelry, right? That was the highest status jewelry you could have now, because instead of saying, hey, look at my personal wealth, it was now, hey, look at my sacrifice that I made for the community. That is an example of controlling badge value without having to distribute it from on high. Instead, we just promote one kind of badge value over another. And we can do that within the system that we have now, and to some degree we do. That's why consumerism as an ethos is something worth talking about. Because none of us would sit around and think about consumerism as the way that we structure an ethic of some sort unless it were suggested to us from everywhere around us, right? We see pictures on advertisements and the like of people very happy with their new truck or their fancy TV or whatever else, and we associate that with being happy because of things. Well, if we never suggested that you would be happy because of things, would people have ever come to that conclusion? I mean, more likely we would be happy because we didn't lack things, right? Lacking food, lacking shelter, lacking, you know, warm clothes. Those things cause us unhappiness. And so we know that that's a connection. But once you have those things, once you have the things that make us not suffer, right, because of conditions in the world, we would probably just naturally go, okay, well, there's enough of that. But then greed comes into it somewhere.
Well, and back when they first started, like, when advertising really started taking off as more than something like, hey, we have this thing that you may need, like the Sears catalog sort of thing, where we have these things that you may need, you can buy them from us, and started becoming a, we have better things than those other guys, or we have the best thing, it was a lot more bold-faced about it, that it was more... out in the open, more, those guys suck, we're the best, buy our stuff. And nowadays, because that is considered kind of bad form, as far as advertising goes, it tends to be a little more insidious. Having the smiling people, the subliminal stuff that they put in there that makes you go, well, I want this slightly fancier but much more expensive version of this other thing because I perceive that it will make me happier because I can relate to the people in this advertisement or I can relate to the situation in this advertisement.
That's another stage where advertisement really stepped it up, was not just going from we have this thing, you can buy it from us, to those other guys suck and we're awesome. It also went to where I think it jumped off the page there, is where it said, if you buy this, if you have this, you're the kind of person who has this. If you watch those really old commercials when, like, one product would sponsor the whole show, you know, brought to you by Frigidaire. And then they come in and they say, and they have a guy standing next to a Frigidaire. Here's the Frigidaire, and here's the ice maker, and here's the temperature. And he'd talk for 5 minutes about all of the features of the refrigerator. Now you do a commercial for pretty much anything, and they're going to talk about its features or what it can do at all in the commercial. Instead, they're going to show cool, hip people who are vaguely associated with it who you'd like to be. And with badge value, there's a kicker. It's not just that, oh, I'd like that so the community likes that. If I can't afford that and the guy next to me buys it, I'm going to be jealous of him, and that's going to give him additional psychological boost for having bought it.
The way that these things are presented to us is very specifically intended to elicit that response. There's a point around the beginning of the 1930s or so when we start to see this shift happening in American advertising. Up until, well, actually through the Depression, most ads are really just a very simple sort of, here's our product, here's what it does, and here's how much it costs. As a matter of fact, if you look back specifically, camera ads are great for this, because cameras at the time are sold on this basis of, here's how fast it goes, here's how big the pictures that it makes are, and here's the total price. And you will see these newspaper ads that are literally white and black with a little square rectangle, and inside of it, name of camera company, address to send money to, list of prices. Like, that's all there is to it. There is no attempt to tell you anything about the product beyond that, because you already know what a camera is. You know what a camera does, and if you're going to send the money, you already know what kind of camera you want in the first place. So the only thing they have to do is say, hey, we have cameras, and here's how much they cost. Then Edward Bernays comes along. Edward Bernays was Sigmund Freud's nephew and had early access to some of his work, and he began a trend of building PR and advertising functions in that played on our psychology in the first place, that took basic needs that we all had and said, this product can satisfy your need for you. If you feel the need for closeness and connection in your life, make sure you're buying Tide laundry detergent, because otherwise you'll smell bad and no one will want to be around you, right? We see this probably most prevalently in car commercials, where he was playing on Freud's notion of the death wish. Basically, show your car going fast, driving around tight curves, not how safe it is with your family inside and how you're going to cruise along through the meadow and have a great picnic. Show the car racing along through dangerous curves and how exciting and amazing it's going to be, and fulfill for the consumer the fantasy of being in this perilous circumstance. And until Edward Bernays develops this model of how to sell things, all of our advertising is basically focused on, here's a thing, here's how much it costs, and here's what it does. After that, it's, you need this thing, you want this thing, your desires are manifest as this thing. Is there a tiger in your tank? Right? These kind of catchphrases that play on our underlying emotional statuses, and in some ways supplant the values that we would otherwise carry into a purchasing decision, are a deeply manipulative system that has been built up specifically to cause us to behave in particular ways. And we have to ask ourselves at some point, is that what I want, right? Because we're being fed wants, we're being fed desires, we're being fed, you should want to be socially acceptable, so make sure you're wearing our cologne. You should want to be viewed as someone who keeps a nice house, so make sure you're buying our window cleaner. But we have to ask as individuals if that's what we actually want, or just what we're being told we want. Because if we form an ethic based on what someone else tells us we want, that doesn't mean we'll get to happiness. It means we'll be told we'll get to happiness. And that, at its core, in my opinion, is why money can't buy happiness. Because money can buy the promise of happiness. Money can buy the product that tells us what will make us happy. But we can't buy something to make ourselves happy if we don't know what we want in the first place.
If we're saying money's buying happiness, we're talking about a psychological need. And advertising does try to attach material objects to psychological needs, but only so far as creating the desire in us. Whether or not the desire is fulfilled doesn't matter. They've already made their sale. So I'd like to say that maybe informed consumerism would be a better way to go. It allows us to align with each other somewhat without taking it too far, but informed doesn't really quite cut it, because to question psychological manipulation actually takes more than just education, it takes introspection.
Sure, you have to be willing to put to use the tools that can be provided by education, otherwise they're not going to do any good in that circumstance.
Right, and you have to really look at yourself and ask, not just do I need this, but what do I really want?
And I mean, some of this has been curbed a little bit. Organizations like the Federal Trade Commission, the Better Business Bureau, and the like, have at least prevented advertisement, by and large, from being a pack of lies. I mean, there was a time in which there were companies promising the world for buying their product and very obviously being unable to deliver. There have since been some forms of consumer protection, but it's still very much a long-running problem.
Well, if nothing else, we have the concept of puffery still with us. That a company can make outlandish claims, just so long as those claims are so outlandish that a reasonable person wouldn't have believed them to be true, right? The example that's come up somewhat recently is Red Bull always assumed Red Bull gives you wings would be considered puffery. How could any person believe that drinking something in this can would suddenly cause you to sprout wings? Well, as it turns out, there was a case made against them for that. Basically, that not would someone believe they'd literally sprout wings, but that the implication of it was that you would be a better performing athlete, that you would move faster, all the symbolism of wings would be imparted on you. And after some study, they found that there was absolutely no improvement in athletic performance from someone who had drank Red Bull and someone who hadn't. That's a case where puffery got called out, but we have puffery in almost every form of advertising now, because it's the great loophole that lets the lies back in.
As long as it's an abstract thing, or an internal psychological state, which isn't objectively measurable, due to privacy of thought, you know, courts can't really intrude there, they can say, this will make you happy.
Certainly, and maybe not in such words, but definitely can imply it through images they provide on screen, or what the context of which the advertisement goes out.
Well, sure, and that's where we see the shining, happy people everywhere, right? That's why everybody in every commercial looks like they're so gosh darn happy when they have the product that commercial is selling, and so incredibly unhappy when they don't.
Actually, another excellent example that comes to mind is almost the opposite of that, which is the infomercial-like commercials where someone's life is shown as being completely and absolutely unable to continue without a product that they provided, like a new type of pasta strainer or a new way to cook eggs in the microwave. The implication being that you cannot continue living your life while not having this product, even though the people on the TV screen are just ludicrously inept at whatever they're doing.
It's people who cannot hold up a bowl of popcorn without dumping it all over themselves, so you need to buy the special popcorn bowl holder, and then everything goes to black and white all of a sudden as they're throwing their food around.
You know, it strikes me with consumerism as an ethos. Aren't infomercials basically public service messages?
How so, Professor Metal?
Well, they're showing us the things that we need in order to continue existing in our society.
But if they create the desire and then fulfill the desire they created, I have a net gain of nothing, but I've lost my money.
Well, you know what they say about a fool and his money.
That's fair.
I would like to have some money to get parted with.
No.
I was sucked in by this when I was about 15 years old. I, at that tender young age, watched an infomercial for some new mandolin slicer for vegetables, and was absolutely convinced that I needed to have this thing for only, you know, $35 or whatever. It got there, and it was the same plastic piece of crap, but they had sold me the idea that how could I possibly want to go throughout my life without the ability to make crisp-cut fries at my house. I was sold. I was 100% hooked. And it wasn't until it got there that I realized I didn't have a deep fryer. I hated vegetables. What 15-year-old wants to eat a salad with special little cut-up pieces of something? No, I wasn't a product I needed in any way, shape, or form. But the people in those black and whites, They were just crushing tomatoes, slicing their fingers, bleeding everywhere. These people would have died within 5 minutes of the time this commercial was filmed if this was an actual lifestyle of theirs.
And that's kind of where it comes from. It's not necessarily the concept that I am as bad as the people on the TV screen, but that if this product makes such a world of difference for the quote-unquote model family that is presenting it, it must make my life so much easier. That is, in no uncertain terms, an out-and-out lie. Like, maybe there'll be a product out of every dozen that'll make things actually easier for you. But most of it's just a new fancy coat of paint on something that's already been around for years.
River, silence. Bruce, I grant unto you the last word.
Ooh, thanks. So we've talked for rather a while this evening about happiness, value, consumerism, what you're buying when you buy something beyond just what it is. People often say that it's important to be an informed consumer, but given the role of advertising and the way that we view products these days, that's not enough. I think it's also important for us to be an introspective consumer. Figure out what your needs are, psychological or otherwise, what you value, what you want, and then determine whether or not a product can help fulfill that, if not completely do so. It might not be a sufficient cause for happiness, but it could be a necessary cause, or at least a causal factor. On a personal note, for a long time I had a severe anxiety disorder about leaving my house. I got a cell phone, and I knew what time it was, when the bus schedules were, pull up a map of where I was, or call someone at any time. That made me feel much safer about venturing out and going around town and participating as a functional member of human society. Although that was definitely a psychological factor, it wasn't entirely arbitrary. It wasn't just nothing. As to the real question, can money buy happiness? Setting aside all of the psychology, all of the sociology, the economics, and the philosophy, the simple answer is yes. From Professor Metal, you can buy pure happiness per pound, delivered straight to your door. Extracted from depressed philosophers using the latest in existentialist technology, this happiness can be brought to you, injected in you, and you will be happy. Simply donate any amount to our Patreon page, and you will receive a corresponding quantity of happiness beamed directly to you from elsewhere. Satisfaction with the happiness is unfortunately not guaranteed.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. Send us your questions. And if you like what we're doing here, support us on Patreon. Join us next time after I finish my market research on commoditizing communism. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Bruce.
I'm River.
And I'm Sean. So, the new metal crate got here, but mine was empty.
So was mine.
I got a box. I've always wanted a box. I'm so happy!
Steve, get the extractor.
Security, slavery, it's better than the dark. Shade in the woods, more awful by far. Leaving children for mortal pursuits, learning rules, who cares if it's rigged? Better losing, at least you know what's coming.